Welcome to Business Watch. Well, the South African stock market fell for only the third time in the past 18 months in April as risk appetite soured globally. There were few places to hide on the local bourse, though coal exporter Thungela continued to benefit from surging global energy prices. The stock up 48% month on month and 222% higher year to date to the end of April, having risen 11-fold since listing less than a year ago. Sasol, the other local beneficiary of higher energy prices, was up 11% month on month. And we've started May with most global markets giving in to the bears. Bonds rising, the dollar strengthening, and central banks eating lots of humble pie, it seems. The diary is full of Fed speakers this week, which will give them plenty of opportunity to keep up with the hawkish chorus. Let's find out what the animal spirits are telling us with Chris Holdsworth, Chief Investment Strategist at Investec Wealth and Investment. Chris, good to see you again. And sadly, COVID is rearing its head again, specifically in China, or the Chinese response, shall we say. In the last month, we've seen sweeping lockdowns across the country, crimping manufacturing, stay-at-home orders have stunted consumer spending, talks of robo-dogs and drones. The closures are also compounding supply chain issues that have boosted inflation, and that's all weighing on global growth. What are the PMIs telling us?
Hi, Michael. Yeah, they're signaling that there has been a definite slowdown in growth across the globe in April. But we need to be a bit careful here because that's the average number for the entire global economy. And it's distorted somewhat by what's currently occurring in China, which you referred to about robot dogs and the like. They've shut down pretty severely. And as a result, the PMI reading for China, which is a high frequency reading of economic activity, has declined to below 40. Now, any number below 50 indicates an economic contraction. Below 40 indicates a severe contraction. And this is largely due to the lockdowns that we've seen. If you look at economic activity in other countries across the globe, like the US and Europe, there have been slight declines for some of them, but the numbers are still well above 50, indicating that global growth is still positive. So what that tells us is that we've seen a deceleration in global growth in April, largely due to what's happened in China. We know that playbook at some point, once the COVID cases start to come down, they reopen again, and then we'll see a boost. So at this point, a slowdown in global activity, but likely to be temporary. And even after the severe decline in Chinese activity, still nowhere near the point at which global growth is actually going backwards. So all told, little reasons for concern on the growth front at this point, looking at the latest high-frequency data.
I suppose the big question for markets is, can China preserve both its economy and its zero-tolerance COVID-19 policy? Any thoughts on that?
Those do seem to be two completely different goals, and it doesn't seem possible at all. There are only two ways you can get around this. Either you vaccinate everyone with an effective vaccine, or you get herd immunity. You could do a combination of both, but China hasn't really pushed the frontier on either one of those. So they're likely to have this problem for some time. Zero COVID doesn't seem very realistic in that environment, which means we can expect continuing regional shutdowns until they reach a point of herd immunity, which will likely take some time. Alternatively, they just have to bite the bullet and widely distribute the vaccines that have been developed in the West.
Yeah, absolutely. And why we look at things like money supply as well to see what the global economy is telling us. So firstly, why is money supply such a good indicator of economic health? And then what is the global monetary supply growth data revealing?
Well, typically money supply growth is a strong leading indicator for both inflation and economic growth. If money supply growth is rapid, then typically, you know, down the line, you'll likely see some form of increase in prices. So when we had U.S. money supply growth of up 25% year on year, just post COVID as a result of the stimulus, we knew with some degree of confidence that there would be a sizable uptick in inflation down the line in the US, and that's exactly what's occurred now. But what we've seen of late is a pretty meaningful slowdown in money supply growth in the US. Total money supply growth is up just over 9% year on year in the US, so that's down from the growth above 20%. But if you look at the latest monthly data, in March it was up less than 0.5%. So there's been a material deceleration. And what that tells us is that we should be penciling in a deceleration in inflation as well. That's if we're simply looking at money supply numbers. We can look at other factors, which I'm sure we'll talk about shortly. But the money supply argument for heightened inflation is dissipating very rapidly. And in fact, at some point soon, we are likely to enter into a disinflationary argument simply looking at the money supply numbers.
Yeah, and also if you look at what the Fed is going to be doing in terms of quantitative tightening. Now, the days, if you look at the U.S. labor market as well, we had that printout on Friday, the days of millions of job gains per month are certainly behind us, and the U.S. labor market recovery has been moved in to what looks like a new phase. What really stood out for you in those jobs numbers on Friday?
Yeah, it was still a pretty good number. We're looking at close to 430,000 jobs added in a month, which is in line with where it was the month before. And I say it's pretty good for the U.S. economy to be adding this number of jobs, especially when you consider that they're very close to the pre-COVID levels of employment. They're less than 1% off, and they'll probably get there in June. And what that tells us is we've now reached the point pretty much where jobs are in line with where they were pre-COVID. We've still got 2 years to catch up. So we're not yet at capacity constraints in from that perspective, from a labor perspective, but we're heading in the right direction. So a very encouraging print. If you look at wage growth, it's still pretty strong. It's actually picking up. The labor market is very tight, especially at the low end. Wage growth for restaurant workers is up over 16% year on year, as an example. So it's an environment where companies are trying to get people employed. There are more jobs on offer than people looking for jobs. We've got 11.5 million jobs that are advertised in the U.S. You've got about 6 million people looking for work. If you're in the U.S. and you want a job, there's jobs to be had. And companies are having to start to push up wages to get people employed. Having said that, wage growth is still below inflation. Average wage growth is up about 5.5%. If you adjust for baskets and a few technical adjustments you can make, then it's up around 4%. But inflation in the U.S. is 8.5%. So the narrative that's building in the market that wage growth is driving inflation is not true. And companies, their top lines are growing by 8%. That's what inflation is. Their wage cost is only growing up by 4%. And so at this point, it's not the case that wages are driving inflation. Now, it might be the case in 6 to 12 months' time if interest rates are kept very low and they allow the market to run very hot, then we land up in a position like that. But that's not where we are now. Where we are now is inflation is materially above wage growth, and the Fed's focus should be on controlling inflation rather than being concerned about the possibility of an increase in wages.
Yeah, unless, as you say, you're lucky enough to be in the restaurant sector where you're seeing 16% growth, but that isn't certainly what we're seeing through the rest of the economy. Now, speaking of the Fed, hiked by 50 basis points last week, and we've discussed this a lot over the last few months. Does this consistently higher core PCE inflation capitulation persist? I mean, how are you reading it?
Yeah, we think we passed peak inflation. Inflation is likely to come down now, and we'll get the next reading on Wednesday for a number of different reasons. As an example, used car prices have come down again. They're now down 1% over the past month. That's 4% of the basket. So that's going to shave a bit off inflation. Fuel prices have come down. That'll shave a bit off inflation too. Longer term, looking down the line, there's a vast number of homes currently under construction in the U.S., the largest amount that we've seen since the 70s. We're going to get a massive amount of housing stock hitting the market quite shortly. That'll put downward pressure on house prices. That will cap rent increases as well. If you look at transit costs for shipping across the globe, they're down about 25% off their recent peak. So everywhere we look, we're seeing disinflationary pressures start to come through. And as a result, inflation will start to drift down. The previous reading was 8.5. The consensus forecast for Wednesday is 8.1. That's not really the bit that we should be focusing on. It's rather where's inflation going to be by the end of this year. And we think it will have a 4 handle, to be honest, in which case the Fed doesn't need to be as aggressive as they've signaled. They've hiked by 50. The market thinks they're going to hike by 50 bips next month, and then another 50 bips the month after, and then a 60% chance of a 50 bip hike the month after that. And the reality is if inflation continues to decline at the rate that we think that it will, the Fed will hike, but they won't hike as aggressively as is widely expected. So that'll be positive for equities in general. It'll be positive for growth stocks as well. But we do need to keep an eye on the Fed's balance sheet. And this is the uncertainty. I mean, we've got a long history of changes in Fed funds rates and what that it means for equities. We can model it. We know typically what happens when the Fed hikes by 25 or 50 bips. What we don't know is what happens to liquidity in equity markets and bond markets when the Fed's balance sheet is reduced by $90 billion a month, which is what will happen in 3 months' time. From June, they're going to start to reduce it by about $45 billion per month. So that's the area of uncertainty that we focus on. We're quite relaxed about the Fed itself. We don't think they're going to hike aggressively. And even if they do, we understand what that will mean for markets. Where we're uncertain is on that balance sheet story and QT and what that means. And there is a question mark. We don't know. We don't think anybody actually does know either. We just have to hang fire for a couple of months to be able to get an early estimate of what impact that is having on global markets.
Well, let's just expand on that quantitative tightening, QT as it's become known, and we're talking about a huge unwind here. What is it, $9 trillion US dollars that has been built up on the Fed balance sheet over time. As that liquidity starts to be removed from the system, surely we're likely to see an impact on asset prices, and already, you know, the talk is that we're going to see that oxygen for more speculative investments start to come out the room, things like, venture capital, cryptos, that kind of thing. How do you potentially see this QT playing out?
Yeah, I think a lot of damage has been done to those sectors already because the U.S. long bond yield has picked up in anticipation of the Fed's actions. So at the beginning of the year, the 10-year bond yield in the U.S. was about 1.5%. It's now up to 3%. It's picked up quite aggressively. And in that environment, speculative assets simply get crushed. As an example, venture capital in the U.S. is down over 50% off its recent highs. Bitcoin is now trading below $40,000. And there are a vast array of other speculative instruments, NFTs and the like, that have been absolutely hammered as the concern around the Fed reducing its balance sheet has been incorporated into markets. Now, it's often the case that the anticipation of something is worse than it actually occurring when it comes to markets. So perhaps once the Fed actually starts to reduce the size of its balance sheet, some of these speculative instruments actually get a bit of support because some of the uncertainty is removed. But the damage already has been gargantuan, especially when you compare that to equity markets where the fall has been much more mild than some of these other instruments. But because there is this question mark and we don't actually know, we still say, let's just hang fire for a little bit until we can fully incorporate a decline of the Fed's balance sheet into our models of both speculative and more traditional asset classes as well.
But it would mean then, you know, after waiting to see what the impact will be, that if it is fairly benign, then it would be hugely supportive for equities, and some might go out and fill their boots. The dollar, if you look at where the dollar's been at the moment, I mean, it obliterated all comers last week, and I think it surprised a lot of commentators as well. What does that mean, firstly, for the global economy?
Typically, an environment of dollar strength is associated with an environment of weak economic activity. The dollar is a contraindicator. It's a safe haven asset. Typically, what happens is when there's heightened uncertainty globally, there's a flight to safety, money goes into the U.S. and the dollar strengthens. And what we've seen of late is no different to the usual sort of approach. The dollar now is the strongest that it's been in the past 5 years. And that, we could say, is partly due to Russia invading Ukraine. It's partly due to the shutdowns in China and the uncertainty around global growth as a result of that, the PMI numbers we made reference to earlier. And in addition to that, uncertainty around European growth, given the spike in energy prices in Europe. So for all those reasons, the dollar becomes attractive, money flows into the US, and other currencies get clobbered. And that's exactly what's happened to the Rand. So over the past month, the Rand has weakened by about 8%. We would look at that, we would say, well, that's due to SA-specific factors, but it's not true. If you look at the Rand's weakness, it's not materially different from the Brazilian real or the Norwegian kroner. All commodity exporting currencies have been absolutely hammered over the past month. We've been hammered a little bit more, so it's probably a bit to do with Eskom that's in there as well, but not massively more. We are still being driven by global winds rather than SA-specific. And at the moment, if one happens to be a commodity exporting country and you're not Saudi Arabia, there's massive pressure on your currency.
Yeah, and no doubt it'll also have a big impact as to how the Premier League plays out with the likely two biggest clubs or the bottom clubs being Manchester City and Newcastle, depending on which way the oil price is going to go 5 years from now. Now, how likely is the dollar to remain at these levels over the course of the year, considering that surprising strength that we've seen. And considering what you've just said potentially about inflation topping out and the Fed might not being as aggressive as some commentators think it has to be.
Yeah, a strong dollar has real world consequences. I mean, it's strengthening because of concerns around risk. But what that means ultimately is if you're sitting in the US, imports from the rest of the globe are very cheap and exporting US goods becomes very expensive. So where we're sitting now is that the trade deficit in the US is simply gargantuan. It's over $100 billion per month. It's the highest that we've ever seen before. And that in itself puts pressure on the dollar. So there are a couple of reasons to believe that the dollar will weaken from this point going forward. For one, at some point, the Chinese will reopen again as the COVID cases roll over. That should see some form of risk on globally. At some point, the Russian-Ukraine conflict will come to an end. Next couple of months, next year, whenever it is, that will take away some support for the dollar. But in addition, that trade deficit puts pressure on the dollar as it is. So it'll take a little while to come through. In the next month or so, we probably still have a pretty elevated environment with regards to uncertainty. But subsequent to that, I think there are a number of reasons to expect, A, that the dollar weakens, but B, that will imply rand strength, Brazilian real strength, Norwegian krona strength for a number of currencies across the globe.
Turning to equity markets now, I think last week we saw the NASDAQ losing around 1.5%, the S&P and the Dow dropping 0.2% and 0.25% respectively. So not a terrible week, but it was the sixth straight losing week for the Dow and the fifth straight for the other two major indices. And year to date, all down over 10%. How many times has this happened in history?
Now, from the 50s through to now, we've had 18 occasions when the U.S. equity market has had a drawdown of more than 10%. So it happens every, call it 3 or 4 years or so. So it's not incredibly unusual. And if you look at the drawdown at the moment for U.S. equities, it's around 14%, which when you look at other occasions when there's been a drawdown of more than 10% and no U.S. recession, isn't very extraordinary. We've had about 84 days from the high through to now. The median in a non-recessionary environment is around 100. Market's down 14%. If there's no recession, typically on average, it's down around 20 in a phase where there's a drawdown of more than 10%. So we're not far off what would be a typical drawdown in a non-recessionary environment. The key call for us is the U.S. going to go into recession or not? Because if the U.S. is going to go into recession, then drawdowns typically last over 300 days. And there's another 15% or so for the U.S. market to correct. Now, our belief is that the U.S. is not going to go into recession in the next 12 months, in which case we don't think there's much further to go for the U.S. correction. And this is one way to look at it. We look at it in a couple of other ways as well. But that is the key call for an individual. If one believes that the U.S. is in fact going to recession, then equity markets, even after the recent correction in the U.S., do not look attractive.
What has this done to valuation levels in U.S. markets? Because we have seen the U.S. market on a historical basis being fairly fully priced.
Now, we entered into this period with this regime with a very well-priced U.S. equity market. It was around 25 to 30% above the typical PE for the U.S. market. It was a massive premium. And then we landed up with the Fed hiking and earnings growth has decelerated as well. So you would naturally expect that there would be a derating. And even after the pullback in markets, the U.S. is still trading at about a 10% premium to its 15-year history. So it's still not cheap after the pullback. It's definitely not a dripping roast. But if you look at other countries around the globe, the picture is somewhat different. Europe, emerging markets, Japan, they all trade at a 10 to 15% discount to their 15-year median. And they've got some pretty decent earnings growth as well. So the thesis that the rest of the world should outperform the U.S., I think, can be well supported for a number of different arguments, including the dollar argument we spoke about before.
Yeah.
But valuation is a pretty strong argument as well. The U.S. is still at this point not cheap, even after the very large correction that we've seen.
Again, supportive for SA Inc. equities, if we can just get a few of our policy ducks neatly in a row and quacking, because we seem to be very good at announcing new initiatives, not very good at following through on them. Let's just stay on the bond story, though, because that really is where the real story is happening in markets, isn't it, Chris?
Yeah, there's been a lot of ink put down around the correction we've seen in U.S. equity markets. But the reality is what we've seen in the U.S. bond market is far more significant. And bond market volatility in the U.S. now is the highest that we've seen since the global financial crisis. If you hold a basket of treasuries, the drawdown in that portfolio at this point would be around 14%. That's the highest drawdown that we've seen for treasuries in the 50 or 60 or so years of history that we've got. It's absolutely massive. Now, treasuries are supposed to be the safe haven asset. And in an environment where U.S. equities have gone down 13%, which is, you know, pretty normal for equities, bonds have gone down 13 to 14% as well. And that's very abnormal for bonds. And it's not just that U.S. government debt has been hammered. And corporate credit's been hammered too. If we think of an example, Apple. Apple's got a bond that vests in 2040. Apple's got a bond which vests in 2060. And it's been absolutely clobbered. It's down 29% year to date. But Apple equities are only down about 15% year to date. So credit has been hit more heavily than equities. It's an unusual environment where bonds have been hammered, credit's been hammered too, and multi-standard deviation events. And as a result, the equity market is acting normally. We're still quite relaxed about it. It's a bond market where there's been this huge correction. And now, unlike equities, the U.S. bond market is starting to screen as being attractive. You've got the 10-year bond yield at around 3% or so. In an environment where the long-term inflation target is 2%, you know, that starts to offer value, and it's the first time in a very long time that U.S. fixed income has started to look attractive.
And that is a very interesting observation. We're also into the tail end of U.S. earnings season. What do the numbers reveal so far, Chris?
Now, the vast majority of companies that have reported have surprised on the earnings front. You're looking at about 80% or so. But there have been relatively small surprises. And if you look at earnings in aggregate for the S&P 500, for Q1, it's looking like it's going to be up around 9% year on year. But if you strip out energy, it's up around 3% year on year. So these are not very strong earnings numbers for sectors outside of energy. But in addition to that, if you look at the companies that have beaten on the earnings line, you look at their share price performance in and around the period when they've beaten, it's actually been slightly negative. There's been no reward for the companies that beat. On the flip side, if you look at the companies that have had earnings results that have disappointed, they've typically been hammered. So there's an asymmetry here. Companies that miss get clobbered. Companies that report above or in line, they don't perform materially. And it's just evidence of very heightened expectations with regards to the market and earnings, and just reason for a bit of caution now, even after the correction. I think we just need to wait to see what's going to happen in earnings the next couple of months. We need to see what's happening with the Fed's balance sheet as well. Even after the pullback, this isn't exactly the time to be jumping in feet first to U.S. equities. There is still reason for a bit of caution.
And then there's, you know, just to throw in for good measure, the way the consumer is going to respond in a still post-COVID environment. We're still seeing some of that play out in some of the retail and travel numbers as well. Turning our attention to the local economy, Chris, commodities have come back a little, but we still see a healthy trade balance, don't we, even though we have seen some commodities come off their recent highs.
Yeah, this is the opposite situation to the U.S. Our trade balance is positive and very large. In March, it was over $40 billion. The 12-month total is now over $400 billion. And we've now had a positive trade balance for nearly 2 years in a row. And the underlying thesis that we've spoken about elevated commodity prices providing support for the rand, for the fiscus in South Africa, and ultimately the consumer in South Africa, still holds. Over the next couple of months, we'll have a bumpy ride for commodities, in our view. We're seeing a slowdown in Chinese demand, and that's typically not good for commodities. At some point, Russia's invasion of Ukraine will come to an end, and that may well see a decline in commodity prices too. But there's still long-term structural tailwinds for commodities. If we think about the energy transition as an example, global infrastructure spend is another. Those provide long-term support for our trade balance, for the currency, and for all the other good consequences for that for SA. We don't think it's time to be shifting one view on the long-term outlook for SA growth. We still think that expectations for the SA economy are too low relative to the rest of the globe. We expect positive surprises to come. And as a result, we're still pretty constructive on SA Inc. in general.
And speaking of SA Inc., mining in Durban kicking off today in Cape Town. What's your expectation for commodity prices for the remainder of the financial year, Chris. And as we get to the end of our conversation, it really is very important to realize that there's a huge opportunity here. One of the Business Day subs thought there was a typo in my column today when I mentioned that if you live in the West, you use 57 kilograms of newly mined mineral every day. I don't think most people understand just how much we consume and our severe resource constraints, to your earlier point. So I think this is a very important point to belabor when it comes to things like U.S. spending on infrastructure.
Now, there is a huge amount of opportunity out there at the moment for mining companies. If we think of the medium-term outlook, so I'll just not answer your question directly. I'll look at the medium-term and then the shorter term. Over the medium-term, there's a huge need for infrastructure investment in the U.S. in particular. Bridges. On average throughout the U.S., bridges are increasingly old, increasing out of shape. They need to do a lot of work. If you look at dams in the U.S., the average age of a dam in the U.S. is over 50 years. There are 2,200 dams in the U.S. that are categorized as being in a poor state. They need renovation. There's a broad need for infrastructure investment in the U.S. So just as we may well see a slowdown in China, we're going to see an uptick in commodity demand from the U.S. At the same time, we've got this huge energy transition plan, which is currently unfolding throughout the globe. A number of countries committing to zero emissions by 2050, and that is massively metals intensive. We've seen the lithium price go up 6 times, as an example. Companies want to go and put a new lithium mine in Chile. The local community says no, because it's polluting.
Yeah.
So in this environment of very strong increases in demand, we're not seeing massive increases in supply. Mining companies have been uniquely disciplined. Typically in this environment, they would just dig deeper holes in the ground. But partly as a result of ESG investing and financing from banks, that's not occurring. So we may well see a bumpy ride over the short period to answer what's going to happen over the shorter term. As mentioned earlier, there's a slowdown in China. At some point, Russia and Ukraine will be resolved. There'll be an increase in supply and commodities, reducing demand. That's typically not good. So it'll be a bumpy ride. But over the medium to longer term, It's hard to be pessimistic in the space at the moment, given the plans from across the globe to increase demand for commodities, and there's no material plans for increasing supply. So short term, bit of a bumpy ride, but long term, we still think there's structural arguments for commodities doing very well. Absolutely. Over the medium term. Until technology comes along and you find a replacement for lithium in batteries, but that's not going to happen overnight. So we're still quite comfortable with the commodity core for the medium to longer term.
All very positive for South Africa, if we can get our policy environment right and welcoming. Thanks, Chris. We're going to have to leave it there. Chris Holdsworth, Chief Investment Strategist at Investec Wealth and Investment, with the animal spirits here on Business Watch.